Welcome, listener, to another podcast with a K. This episode with me, James McLean, is going to be reviewing, I guess, the latest episode of Doctor Who, which was on Christmas Day, The Church of Ruby Road, which is technically the first episode of, I think, the 14th season or 14th series of Doctor Who since 2005. Today, spice things up a little bit. We've not got Christian with us. We have a guest reviewer, I think we will call them. The reviewer is a colleague of mine who goes by the name of Magnus.
Hello. Magnus.
Yes. Before we start, because I'm sure there'll be some nerds listening to this who will be thinking that maybe this is a name relating to Doctor Who in some way. So we need to confirm, first of all, that you are not the, nor coined from, the 51st century criminal Magnus Greel, previously known for their time travel antics to the 19th century London disguised as a Chinese god called Wing Chiang. You're not that Magnus Greel, are you? Nor are you associated to that name?
No, just a happy coincidence.
It's just a happy coincidence. Nor are you identifying to, although it would be quite cool if you were, the werewolf named Mags, who was a potential victim of the Cosmic Circus, later to become a companion to the Seventh Doctor in his audio media-based adventures. You're not Mags either.
Again, just happy coincidence.
Just a happy coincidence. So there, nerds, just to make sure you didn't think that there was some sort of weird, sort of fun, nerdy in-joke going on here, there is none. We don't do that.
We should have left it.
Or just gone with Magnus and just let them think that it might have been
something.
Let
them draw their own conclusions.
Yep. I don't want to give them that sort of pleasure. I don't want them to think that they've spotted some in-joke, which isn't there.
People like to feel clever.
Yeah, but I don't like people to feel clever because it makes me feel that they think they're more clever than me because they'll have worked out this in-joke. So it's better to sort of just stop them in their tracks and make sure they know their place. Yep. They're the listener. They don't have a voice. That's how it is, Magnus. Enjoy the sense of power. Indeed. So a little bit about your relationship to Doctor Who, Magnus. Maybe that's a good approach, given that you are not Magnus Greel or Mags the werewolf.
My relationship to Doctor Who, as in how much of it I've watched, my credentials. Yeah.
I mean, imagine that up until about 4 minutes ago, people didn't know there was even going to be a Magnus on this podcast. So they might be thinking, well, you know, OK, this is not Magnus Greel. This is not Mags the werewolf. So who is this person that I am listening to? What have they got to say for themselves?
Almost nothing. Don't think about it too hard. I am just Magnus the Magnificent, very friendly Doctor Who watcher. We will discuss an episode of Doctor Who, and then you may never hear from Magnus again.
That's cool. I like that. That's a very powerful statement to make. So, I mean, is there a Doctor Who that you've watched that you've particularly enjoyed?
I was very attached to the Christopher Eccleston era and kind of thought that one was my favourite for a really long time. I liked David Tennant, but I think I liked the much later David Tennant era, possibly because I just don't like change, so it probably took a while to warm up to him when he started doing it. Didn't really vibe with Matt Smith much. Didn't really vibe with the storyline of, like, his companions either. So I kind of dipped out for a long time. Tried to dip back in again with Peter Capaldi unsuccessfully. I haven't seen any of the Jodie Whittaker Doctor Who, and I think that was partly because I didn't have a TV, so I just didn't have TV on ever. I think I was scared of being disappointed, so I preferred to just kind of appreciate it from afar, which brings us up to now, I guess.
I mean, this is why I thought you would be interesting to have on the podcast, aside from, well, initially obviously thinking it was Magnus Greel, and clearly not, was that you came back to Doctor Who pretty much with the specials in November.
Yes, the specials were great. I loved them. I really enjoyed them.
I mean, Doctor Who must be quite a hard show for you to watch, given, as you say, that to your core you dislike change, and yet Doctor Who largely typifies, it could be sort of exemplified by its massive amounts of change.
Well, I mean, you'd think that. I mean, I certainly think that. There is a lot of change going on, but it seems like there's a broad section of people who think that it's not about any change ever at all. So it's an interesting dichotomy.
Yes, yes, that is true. Anyone who has looked at social media or, I don't know, even fan magazines before that will know, especially Doctor Who fans, have a big issue about change. That's going to be something to look at. So you saw the three episodes prior to the Church of Ruby Road. So you saw the introduction to Shooting Gatworth in the previous episode, The Giggle.
Yeah.
I suppose, how was it like sort of then coming back to David Tennant, who's kind of like, from what you said, where you left off in terms of your tastes with Doctor Who?
Yeah.
And then the movement to Shooty after?
David Tennant was probably the last time that I was watching, like, regularly. And then I've dipped in and out and kind of kept up to date with some of the major plot points. I can't remember how many years it's been since initially David Tennant did it and now. Probably many. Yeah, I definitely remember
14 years,
the,
I guess, but carry on.
It's been, I remember some of the Catherine Tate storyline, and they're just like a really dynamic pair to watch on screen. They've got a really good energy, and I think I just really appreciate the just like the non-sexualization of that relationship. I get a bit fatigued with the often like the romanticized dynamic between the Doctor and his companion. Well, because I started watching it when Christopher Eccleston did it, it was fun and exciting for the Doctor and Rose to be a thing. But then if that tension plays out with the majority of the female companions, it kind of becomes a bit meaningless. So it's, I don't know, I find it really enjoyable to watch Tate and Tennant interact on screen where it's just like a really good friendship and it's very meaningful. So yeah, I enjoyed watching them like get up to hijinks, and it was nice to, it felt like a theme of those three bridge episodes, because he's returned to the David Tennant face. It feels like the state of the Doctor is in flux a bit, and a lot of the events in, you know, his life and in the timeline are actually beginning to catch up. And I think one of the things I've always thought was missing in the show or in the canon was what happens when you put a person under immense amounts of stress and trauma for such a long long time, give them no coping mechanisms or really any long-term friends that he keeps around, and no family really. What happens to that person? I found it quite cathartic. They've used this bridge to, like, I guess, reintroduce some of the other elements of Doctor Who before shifting to a new face. But it doesn't mean that the Doctor's experiences are just continually overwritten. The bi-generation means that the Doctor can keep on being renewed and having, well, for the audience, having new adventures and having new eras, but you still actually have a tangible element of the Doctor, which is just taking a breath and trying to sift through some of those darker experiences.
The two things interesting what you say there is that There's something fun, isn't there, in when a show goes on for, let's be honest, it goes on for too long to some degree, that it can start reevaluating what that journey has meant. And that, as you say, that sort of notion of like, this is like being, what, 60 years of a person who literally just keeps moving on, doesn't really assess what they've done, really.
Just they keep just moving, sort of, don't think about it, don't stop. Can't ever stop, don't stay in one place or one time or with one, you know, one or two people, always keep moving. Doesn't matter if something horrific happens or keeps happening, or you discover, like, you know, awful, like, outside of the realms of human understanding, knowledge that fundamentally change, I don't know, the universe itself. Just keep going.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And I know there's been a couple of times where that's been alluded to, especially in those ones you're talking about, the Eccleston and Davis and Tennant ones, Eccleston and Tennant ones. That, you know, he can't look back. And but I think this was, as you say, the kind of the first time where they really kind of sort of nailed it down and said, you know, this guy really is struggling with trauma. He'd have to be a you know, a human person, to be a living creature, to see so much death and to be involved in all these escapades, which ultimately lead to many people dying in each story. Mm. Many people always die, and he always has to kind of deal with that, or doesn't, as you say, to a point where you get this nice almost coda where it sort of goes, yeah, well, this is him now actually having to stop, and I suppose he doesn't have to deal with it in it, but just almost like stop running from it. Yeah, just take a breath, as you say. I think the other thing you said, which was interesting, when you said it kind of, the bioregeneration allows him to almost feel renewed. And before regeneration's coined back in the 60s, that first one was often sort of, was suggested to almost be a renewal. There was even an argument that Patrick Troughton's doctor was just meant to be a younger version of William Hartnell's older man, that this idea that it was an entirely different person was just not quite there yet. But that say, I like the fact that, you know, we talk about canon, but what has happened recently, as you say, kind of almost renews the whole thing. It just makes it a little more slippery and a little more free to respond to the character, rather than the character have to be stuck in this regimented pattern of new face, new face, new face. But you can sort of go, new face, stop. Character perhaps needs to, you know, there needs something to happen here to sort of acknowledge what's been going on, and we can sort of renew the whole idea with this moment of pleasure. As David said, I think, in the commentary recently, I wanted a regeneration which was happy for once. It wasn't about the death of one character, but could actually be alive. So this all leads us to The Church on Ruby Road, which you watched today. I mean, I watched it a couple of weeks ago. So I'm actually really interested to know what you felt about it, because it's had a lot of sort of mixed vibes from different people, especially different age groups, maybe, and demographics. But what did you get from it?
I thought it was good. I think for me, Doctor Who has always been like quite a contentious show to watch and engage in. Because it's real hit and miss. Just over the years, it's gone through so many phases where it's really good, and then suddenly for no reason, just an episode will just be really weird. But just in terms of like the execution, not necessarily like the ideas. The ideas are usually amazing. It's just, I think, through different like eras and directions and writers, like stuff that aren't right women. So meant a lot of those episodes can be quite just embarrassing in terms of like the dialogue or the actions that female characters take. So that can make it a bit hard for me to enjoy. But yeah, I think it definitely brought like a really fun, lively energy to it. It definitely feels a bit like I've seen a lot of stuff about it being a soft reboot, which I guess it could be, because if you're looking for it on iPlayer, it doesn't come up under Doctor Who. They have all those seasons, and this one is missing. But if you look for it, Doctor Who brackets 2023, this is the only thing that comes up. So it's interesting that even in terms of like looking to go and watch it, it's been separated off a little bit.
Yeah. This is, to some degree, I assume, because it's now not done through BBC Studios, and it's now it's done externally through Bad Wolf as an independent production for the BBC.
Yeah.
So I suppose in that sense, it gives it its sort of separation in the production, in the same way that if you go, as you say, through iPlayer and look at the stuff from the 20th century, is separated out from the production that started in 2005. And also, as Davis again has acknowledged, this is now being distributed on Disney across globally. So there's a very much an awareness of how do you soft reboot it for new audiences and find and give it the right information there, which I think this episode was very much key in this episode to do.
I think the first episode is always the most difficult to execute, because you'll have people watching it for the first time, but also people who have watched it for many, many, many years. So you have to give the right amount of information, and the characters have to respond in the right way. Like, oh, a TARDIS bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. Da, 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 da. And what time travel? But then you have a large section of the audience who's like, yes, yes, we know. Come on. So you have to get that balance. You have to get that balance right, because if the characters aren't surprised by TARDIS, then you know that they don't feel authentic. If they're too surprised, they're annoying.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, I think they got it feels like they got the balance right. Yeah, I think it was a really good opener.
What about, I mean, because something you said, Magnus, that I, without sort of getting too much into the details, you know, you're saying that you didn't feel like Moffat wrote women especially well. So rather than sort of going down the road of attacking that stuff, which has already been undone, what was it, do you think, is the stuff in the new, the four that you've watched, where you feel that women are represented better or written better?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel like less of an anxiety going in, knowing that Russell T. Davis is like a creative force behind it. I don't feel as trepidatious watching an episode about how women will be portrayed. I think the energy is just different. But I think with the Bridge 3 episodes, Tennant and Tate are just they've got a really well balanced dynamic. So it doesn't feel like it's just the Doctor and their female companion that is along for the ride. And Catherine Tate's character, you know, has her own place in the canon. She has her own history with the Doctor, but she also has like a very well defined life in outside of the Doctor. And although the Doctor is very important and she's obviously feeling the loss of something that she doesn't remember, like a friendship that was really important to her, she hasn't, you know, she's lived an entire life. She's made a family. The episode is about how, you know, she has a house, but she gave all her money away. She has a daughter, you know, and so it's like three generations of women that are represented. Her mother's there as well, and she's in a very proactively protective mode. She knows that if the Doctor and Donna see each other, like, you know, terrible, there will be terrible consequences. Yeah, I think they're just very well fleshed out characters with their own agency, which I think can often be overlooked or missing in other eras.
Mm. Again, one of the things which I think is interesting with having you on the podcast, and not to dismiss our other regulars, all of them tend to be sort of men in their 40s, so were very much into the sort of show when it was around in the 80s.
Mm.
When you came into seeing Doctor Who in 2005, or whenever you started watching it with Eccleston, did it feel progressive? Because obviously one of the contentions around here, and especially with the church on Ruby Road, is this a question of progressiveness. Did you feel back then when you watched it, did you feel any of that? How did it feel to you?
So how old was I in 2005?
Magnus has no age, I'm sure.
Magnus is ageless, but let's imagine Magnus was a human person.
Yes, absolutely.
I was quite young. Yeah. Quite young, like still a child. So I think my awareness of progressiveness just didn't exist, right? So I wasn't watching it and thinking that it was a progressive show. I was just watching it as a show. Right. But I was very invested in like the stories and the characters. I think in retrospect, it's left a strong impression, partly because Eccleston only does it for a season. So it's like a clearly defined era. It's got quite like a short running in comparison to other doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't know, I remember it was like an unveiling. It was a really big deal for this show to be brought back. And, you know, lots of people in my family were into Doctor Who, and like, you know, everyone's parents has, or, you know, all grandparents has stories of like, oh, well, when I watched it as a child, I was so scared of the Daleks and they gave me nightmares, da 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 da. It's got a really big cultural, it's left a big cultural impact. So I guess that's partly how I like orientated myself to it. And other than that, it was just, you know, adventures and this sort of underlying romantic tension. And I think if you're young and you start watching it, you are kind of primed to be invested in that tension, because it's like an adventure show that's going beyond the boundaries of time and space. And so you're expecting to be on, like, the characters to be on the frontiers of these things. And then that's the dynamic between the companion and the Doctor kind of cements that. Because I didn't grow up watching, like, the the older series, the older Doctors, that kind of dynamic has kind of carried over for me, I guess. That's where it sort of all stems from, which is why I get easily frustrated when the same sort of tensions play out in the same way between new versions of the Doctor and new companions. Like, it's just the same. It doesn't feel like a character going through change. It just feels like kind of often the female companions are there just because they need, because the Doctor needs them to be, or because the show needs them to be like the accessory. I mean, there are lots of ways that have complicated that, but I guess that was kind of the overriding impression. And I watched, I grew up watching a lot of sci-fi. Like, I watched Farscape, like, with my dad, like, every week.
Cool.
And, you know, sci-fi is about, if you can go beyond the boundaries of time and space, then, you know, anything's possible and anything goes. And you can't really, I guess I have always just seen sci-fi to be progressive, even if I didn't know that's what I was seeing.
Mm.
Like, in Farscape, the female love interest, Erin Soon, is just really hardcore from the get-go and basically doesn't change her attitude towards, like, I guess, the hero character very much. Mm. And I think, in retrospect, she was quite, like, a progressive character to have on TV. But that's only really in retrospect. And because I was mostly consuming sci-fi, I guess I didn't really notice that other female characters weren't given that kind of agency.
Yeah. I think one of the powerful things with Farscape and that sort of agency is how, and I remember being shocked about it when I watched it in that first series, Erin Sung and Crichton sleep together. And that just kills that whole sort of usual sort of run of, will the hero get there? You know, their reward at the end, you know, the constant chase for the woman, that sort of whole James Bond-like approach to, it's just wiped out. It's like, yeah, they've done that now. Let's move on and just see where their relationship goes. And it kind of, that was interesting as well. That sort of really upturned that sort of dynamic that was usually there and shifted the blocks. Yeah, I agree. I think, so in a sense, again, with Ruby Rhode and the recent Doctor Who, and even before that, obviously, with Jodie Whittaker, there's always a bit of tension around people who feel the show is taking on subjects or taking things which it feels like it shouldn't, I suppose, is the way to put it. I'm interested in that whole thing, like you said, when you were a kid watching Eccleston, those sort of things weren't really speaking to you, even if maybe somehow, you know, maybe they did in a way, but the actual topics weren't. Because obviously I remember when I was watching it and there was a lot more sort of references to sexuality, to queerness. There was lots of things going on there that Davis was putting in, and there's a lot of complaints over it. And it's just interesting when you sort of say all that and you think of The Church on Ruby Road, which is actually predominantly a female cast, bar Shuti Gatwa. There are sort of references to suggested references in there. There's all these things, but will they just, again, like you say, go unnoticed?
I think thinking back to the Eccleston era, it felt comparatively dark, a little bit hardcore, definitely more, I don't know. I don't think it would have been stuff that I noticed as a child, but it feels definitely more, I guess, more suggestive or more, I don't want to say adult, but more adult than like this new episode, which was really, really good. But I think discomfort and complaints around the show taking on subjects that it shouldn't don't really hold water, because there's a blink and you miss it trans background character. There's a blink and you miss it barely suggestion around the Doctor's like sexuality or interest, and the rest of it is a very neat story about Boblins kidnapping a baby. It's very I don't want to say tame, but it's tame for, you know, the entirety of Doctor Who when you think about it. Like, what, the Doctor can be responsible for the murder of millions of beings, but heaven forfend if you suggest that the Doctor, when they have a penis, might be attracted to another creature with a penis. Like, I think it says a lot more about the audience than it does about the show.
because there is a lot. There's a lot of fun in this episode, and I, and tonally, it is. In fairness to people who did find it difficult, it is quite different in its tone, regardless of any of those sort of more sort of, I don't want to say identity politics, but those sort of questions. The actual tone of the show, as you say, it's as close to magic as
light,
it comes.
It's quite light and fun, which I think can be, you know, it's good or bad depending on what your tastes are. But I think it's quite important to, if you're doing a soft reboot of a show that has a really long history and has a lot of lore and a lot of fans and has gone through a lot of change, like the lead has gone through a lot of changes. I think it's important for the show to be able to have fun. And the beginning of a new era is a really good place to have that fun.
Well, the first one that Davis did with Eccleston was very light compared to where the series went. It seems a similar tact. What did you think of the musical number? I mean, I know a lot of people found that quite difficult. I actually really enjoyed it.
I thought it was really good. I think I was expecting the goblin singer to sound different. So I guess my only critique would be the singing goblin should sound more goblin.
That's interesting.
But apart from that, I thought it was very good.
They were showing on the making of Confidential, whatever they're calling it now, episode, how much of their singing was actually done live on set and recorded there, which was a little shocking for them.
Impressive.
Pretty good, because they sounded good. But yeah, that again felt different. And I've seen people sort of say, is this to sell it to Disney Plus? And
well, you don't have to sell it to Disney Plus, because Disney is just distributing it. You don't need.
Yeah.
I get where they're coming from, but like, it's just a non-issue, isn't it? Because they're just, I'll be making money regardless, so it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, you look at Disney Plus content, it's across the board with everything. There's no specific tone. And as you say, they're there to distribute. They're not there to particularly, you know,
get their hands dirty. Yeah, and also, they own everything. They've got, like, guys, if you want to worry about Disney, you should worry about Disney. Yeah, because they're one of the most, you know, successful, powerful conglomerates in the globe. The control over media that they have is impressive, to say the least.
And this felt very Russell T. Davis. I mean, I don't know the gentleman, but that having the musical number in there feels like something that I'd imagine he's always wanted to do. To have goblins there is fun. It's, as he would probably say, bonkers. I get all that. One of the things I had issues with in the story, I just didn't feel quite clicked, was the science behind the magic, which is alluded to, but it doesn't quite feel like it flows in the story. It feels a bit, I didn't quite get it enough when Ruby disappears. I just didn't feel that really worked for me.
Yeah, I got it when they were on the ship and he's like, I'm learning the language of work. Being like, okay, so if this was this, then this should be the, I don't know, garbage chute or whatever. That made sense. I think this one of the problems that I come up with again in Doctor Who every so often, which is like, it should work and it should be good. It should be excellent. But there's just some clunkiness, I guess, in terms of dialogue or execution of, you know, a complex idea that doesn't quite make the transition from being written to being, you know, seen by viewers and understood.
Yeah. No, I get that. It sort of sat neatly on the story that they were telling. It just didn't feel like it slotted in.
Yeah, it just, I do sometimes think that Doctor Who can be a victim of his own complexity sometimes. I see where you're going, and I see this probably sounded really great in, you know, the first idea or the first iteration, but sometimes less is more. Maybe the character should have articulated less so that the audience could feel more or fill in the blanks themselves.
Well, it's a bit like in the trilogy with Tennant, where you had this idea of making wishes outside of, so far out in the realms where laws work differently. And you can just do them quite simply without having to go into the and make it too much of a thing. And I did kind of feel like perhaps it would have been better to just really simplified it out. And you can still say it's a science.
Mm. Does it need to be a science?
Well, this is it. I mean, this is what I've always said with Star Trek. I've always felt that Kirk really doesn't give a damn about the science. He just wants to know from Spock is it something he can shoot, or is it something he's going to have to run away from? And when you get into the 80s and you start to have the scripts having to really sort of crunch down the science.
Reverse the polarity!
Yeah, it starts to become a bit blur. And then it's going back to what we were saying earlier, you get to Farscape, which then goes in the opposite direction again and sort of goes, yeah, you know, it's just a thing and we shoot it and Crichton's going to shoot it and Aaron's going to shoot it. And that's the point.
Crichton's going to say, maybe we shouldn't shoot it.
Initially. And then as it goes along, that's all he does.
It becomes clear that you should definitely shoot it.
Doesn't he? His gun's Renoir in the end, isn't it? He has a gun that he names because he's so far from the scientist by the end. It's a great series. If you've not seen it, I would suggest going and seeing it.
I said, yeah, we'll wait.
Yeah, we'll absolutely.
I believe there's four seasons and a mini series, or four seasons and a movie.
Yeah.
Is there a movie?
It's a mini series. It's a mini series of four episodes, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, it's basically a movie. You can watch it as one. It's fine.
I know people, listener, you're thinking, well, I'm here to listen to Doctor Who. But like I said, you've got no power. You can't stop me, Magnus. If we want to talk about Farscape, we will. But back to Doctor Who. So what did you think of Shuti Gatwa?
But I thought he was incredible. He's great. Very charismatic. Beautiful, beautiful human. Mm. It has to be said.
Yes.
I saw him in Sex Education.
Yep.
And he was great in that. But I think he definitely shines being sort of the centre of the screen.
Yes.
I think he definitely has the charisma to hold like a whole show together. I feel almost a little bit sorry for the companion character, because I think it must be quite difficult to try and hold your own against like that kind of powerful personality.
Yeah, I Millie Gibson I was not really aware of because I didn't watch Coronation Street, so I've no background into. I'm told that she was great in Coronation Street, and she's great here. She's fine. She does her job. But like you said, it's not only are you having to play against, you know, a very good actor, but you're also having to play against an actor who can steal the scenes. Because they're designed to steal the scenes, and that to have to play that straight against that crazy is
one of the things I do take issue with is are we really going back to, or not back to, but the doctor and 19-year-old human girl? As somebody who has worked with many young 18 and 19-year-olds. They're usually pretty dumb. And we'll see how it goes. I would have preferred her in canon to be older, but that is it's just me.
No,
it's so 19 and you're listening, I apologise, but in 10 years' time, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
I mean, I also apologise for Magnus here. I, of course, do not share exactly those feelings. And I'm quite happy to allow Magnus to take the hit on that. But I think there is certainly an argument that just logically that the more you experience, the more that you do, the more interesting people are. And there is a certain ageism in culture where characters on television are by 18 extremely savvy, extremely not like how we all were at 18. And I agree with you. I felt the same. I was a little shocked to see that we were going back to what felt like, and it could obviously be entirely different, but feels a bit like, as you were saying, sort of the Rose Eccleston dynamic.
Yeah. I think I'm a bit wary, and yeah, I don't think it reflects badly on the companion, on Ruby, because who wouldn't like fall in love with Shuti Gatwa as the doctor? Like, it's what I would do. But I'll be interested to see how the character kind of holds her own.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I'm fascinated to see how they do this without feeling like they retread. And Davis is not going to want to retread. He's not that sort of writer. This is a show that he has a passion for as well. So I don't think it's intentionally going to go down those roads. But you can't help feeling there are other dynamics to explore. I mean, I know obviously he's passed, but Bernard Cribbins and Shuti Gatwa, that would be really interesting. There's just loads of actors that I would love to see that would bring something slightly different than this notion, which I've always called almost like the 18-year-old, European backpack around road, mm-hmm. That sort of feeling that's what this world is of adventure.
Well, because that is exactly what's happening.
To me, it's always felt vaguely insulting. You have these almost come across these doctors and companions as sociopaths, that they come and take some sort of high adrenaline, dopamine thrill out of these escapades where people are fighting for their lives, dying for their beliefs, or as resistances to oppressions or to governments. And then they shoot off to their next adventure, and it's all an exciting ride. And I'm just like, I don't know if I can get behind that. That feels a bit weird. I've always hoped for them to sort of have companions who kind of had some agency outside of that, like they were looking for something, or they need to get back home, or something which takes them on a wild trip that's not just about getting kicks out of, a crazy world. Yeah.
It'd be interesting if this new arc produces a more kind of sibling dynamic. I don't think it will, but they've both been positioned in this new beginning episode as people who are looking for their past or their parents or parental figures, or trying to figure out where they came from. So it's an interesting thread that kind of binds them together. I mean, obviously for the for Ruby, I guess it is potentially more straightforward because they could just go back in time to when she was abandoned as a baby and be like, hey, why are you abandoning your baby at a church? It's not 1905.
These will be stuff that we'll obviously find out in May when it returns. But for now, in terms of the actual show, would you feel like you could give that episode a rating out of 10 as a sort of like a...
I feel like there's nothing to compare it to. I mean, I think you're putting a lot on to rate it, like the first episode with the brand new doctor and a brand new companion starting a brand new era. It was good. It was pretty good.
That's fine. Just destroy our rating system. I don't mind.
Sorry.
I came up with it.
Do you have a rating have system? Is that what you do?
He makes me do it. I resent it. I just try and find ways of...
I don't know. It feels very normative.
It does a bit.
Very structured, limiting, some might say.
You're now making me angry that I've put up with this for far too long. No.
I mean, if I gave it a rating, a lot of it would be on
how
attractive I find the shooting outward to be, you see. I don't know whether I can unpick that.
I don't want a rating now. No, I'm not doing it. That's of the past.
How helpful are out of 10 ratings anyway? Nobody listens and goes, oh, they gave it 6 out of 10. Don't think I'll enjoy it. 8 out of 10, definitely enjoy it. 2 out of 10, never going to watch it. I mean...
I think it's just something that's come from, back eras of magazine cultures where you couldn't just go below the line and say how much you hated something. You had to go and see what the journalist would give it out of whatever and then get angry with them and disagree with them in your own time without that ability to interact.
This says to me, it feels like the history of... Western male-dominated science yet again forcing things into categories that don't comfortably fit into categories. It doesn't actually help you understand the world any easier, or indeed Doctor Who.
Oh, Magnus, you do have potential to be a villain by the sounds of it.
I am a villain. That's why I'm called Magnus.
Absolutely. I thought there was a few comments left on Facebook, just as you say. These people haven't given it a rating, but there's just a few comments. I just thought I would throw them your way, especially since this sounds to be kind of like the way that you feel that we should be understanding these things that we are consuming by listening to each other. Someone called Lewis has said, definite soft reboot. Shooty is a different doctor for sure, but I feel he'll become a fan favourite in the coming series. I like that with bi-generation, we have a doctor that doesn't need to adjust, that they are confident and ready for action. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's definitely a useful story tactic to have been I think it was very cleverly done. And I really liked the episode, The Giggle. There were lots of elements to it that I really, really liked. Also, that had a musical number as well.
Yeah, it did.
It had a great musical number. Superb.
Yeah, that was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, but because he had that by generation. I really enjoyed this process of the Doctor not just, you know, rewriting himself or generating into a new face, but actually there's two of him now, and the newer one, yeah, hasn't had to adjust as being, say, David Tennant in a new body. They are just already themselves, yeah. And they actually are there to provide support to Tennant's Doctor, which is like, you know, I've got you, this is fine, don't worry about it, I'm just going to go off around the universe, you've got a TARDIS, I've got a TARDIS, you should probably take some downtime, it looks like you're falling apart at the seams. I think that was really, I don't know, I found it very rewarding to watch, and it makes sense for a show that is constantly like you say, perhaps it goes on for too long, but when you have a character who's basically immortal and can just change bodies every so often, but just keeps going and never stops, I think it's good for the show to remain, you know, relevant or as a good piece of media, for it to also build in those, actually, the Doctor is also fragile and vulnerable to the same things that we're all vulnerable to, like trauma and pain and loss. And we can actually meaningfully address some of that in the show whilst also providing you with this brand new shiny Doctor who's also just going to do adventure.
It's, as you said, the ultimate soft reboot, isn't it? That you're able to kind of tie up your 60 years with a resolution and yet carry the show on in a way which can now be fresh and still acknowledge its past, but not feel just like it's going on too long. It's had a breath. We had Andy Walker, a very confident debut story for Shuti. On the strength of this, he's going to be a truly great Doctor! ! An enjoyable knockout adventure with some emotional undertones. I think that's nice. Phil Vernon said, as I said after the Star Beast, I feel like a show not being made for my demographic. Fine, if that's what they're making, I'll just watch Reacher and Clarkson's Farm instead. But I'm not sure.
Is that what they said? They
have said that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I feel like you're typecasting yourself there.
There was a laughy emoticon after, so emoji. So maybe it's said in jest, maybe not. I'm not going to judge.
What was up with the Star Beast?
I suppose in the end. There is some of that stuff there.
Yes. The Star Beast, that's based on an old comic, no?
Yeah, it is.
It's a pre-existing story, so if the issue isn't with the story, I guess the issue must be with other elements of the episode.
It could be. Phil does end with, but I'm not sure making it for Gen Z Zoomers is going to fit with RTD's target family audience. I mean, I certainly like that Phil sort of kind of acknowledges, which is nice to see people sort of say, well, I don't feel this is being made for me. That doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just not made for me. And I can go with that and go, well, that's good. You've acknowledged that just because it's not made for me doesn't mean that it shouldn't have value for others. But then the Gen Z Zoomers, I mean, I still feel like, well, Doctor Who is always to some degree targeted, family audiences, but it has always looked at that sort of young teen demographic. That was always its core space. And so I think it should, personally, I feel it should speak to them more than the people who are moving further down the timeline.
And has Vincent anyone Price, spoken to Gen Z recently? Because I'm pretty sure that they really don't care what we think or do or make or indeed anything. Quite nihilistic, I'd say, and with good reason.
Can't think why,
Number two, when we say family, what do we mean by family audience? Because I think a lot of the time, are we saying parents and children who watch the show together, which I think these days probably doesn't actually happen that much, given the way that we consume, the changes to the way that we consume media and just the screens that we are using, how many people are actually watching live TV, you know, together in one room. Or is it just the parents or is it just young children? In which case, when does family audience become, you know, children's TV? Do Zoomers not belong to families? Do they just pop up out of the ground from weird little shiny eggs?
Yeah.
Like, it's quite a complex way of... we have a very complex relationship with consuming our media now. So I think that does change things, but I think it's kind of...
But I think also, you know, we talk about Zoomers, Gen Z are mothers and fathers. They're not kids, and also...
I mean, maybe they shouldn't be, but many of them are.
But yeah, ultimately, yeah, many of them... Well, I mean, you can have Zoomers who are now Gen Z who are now in their 20s, can't you? So it's...
Horrifying thought.
Horrifying thought, exactly. So, but then... Entertainment's always aimed at that sort of the younger demographic, always has done. Disposable income demographic often. So
yeah, entertainment is usually aimed at the demographic that has the most time or the most disposable income.
Of course.
Change over the decades for different generations.
Yeah.
Like it would have been teens who had, who originally, you know, when we created this like idea of what a teenager was and like disposable income and what we could like target advertise towards them. I feel like disposable income and who has it and so who we should be aiming media at has definitely changed a great deal.
Yes,
which is probably, you know, going to be reflected in the types of media that we make, and especially if you also have to consider who's watching it and where they're watching it and by what means.
Absolutely. And again, the four that we watched, the second episode was quite a dark story in itself. You know, it's not like the show has...
Yeah, but it was so cool.
Yeah.
So cool and weird and creepy.
It felt to me like these four together have shown that the show still has viability. And I think how they've repackaged it, and there's talk of other spin-off series coming out. There's been rumours of Sea Devils series potentially being announced. Whether that's going to happen or not, I don't know, but there's definitely this idea that this is a universe that can be expanded. Is that something that you feel interested in?
I'm mostly disinterested in the vast majority of human existence.
Yeah,
but
typical Magnus.
Indeed. I think of all the media universes, Doctor Who has always been one where it has like unexplored depths. Like, you could make spin-offs from pretty much any point in the Doctor Who timeline, for lack of a better word. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, there's talk of like different TV spin-offs and stuff. I think it's definitely something I could see my way to dipping a toe into, but I lack I like the drive to find stuff. And like I said, often I think I just feel so let down when I'm disappointed by a Doctor Who episode. So I try not to invest too much in it. But I think they're probably just taking advantage of like a revitalization of the franchise. Having new faces is definitely useful and helpful for selling that. I think I'm also suffering from like Marvel franchise fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit, I guess, suspicious of this idea of making lots of interrelated stuff. But that's because I'm, you know, grumpy.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone with the name Magnus, one would assume would be grumpy. But I mean, it's interesting with, as I'm sure you're probably avoiding to be aware of, I think on Disney, Echo has just come out or is coming out, which is another one of the Marvel TV shows. And it's been interesting watching how they've been advertising, and they were having like vox pops of people sort of saying how interesting it was and how you don't have to watch anything else to sort of jump into this, and how it's kind of edgy and sort of made for a little more mature, and that it's not so connected, and this kind of feeling that even that franchise is aware that we need to start creating things which aren't so interconnected, because that's just not where perhaps consumers are anymore. So it will be interesting.
We're exhausted.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exhausted. Remember watching the first Avengers film for the first time, being like, oh wow, this is so cool and so fun, and then however many years later, please, no more, I can't take it.
I think
not only can I not take it, I also can't avoid it.
Yeah, I think I recall rightly, I literally I had to force you to watch the Endgame for Avengers, didn't you? I think because you were just exhausted from
It's too much and it's too long and there's too many films, too many stuffs, too many people. I only have a certain amount of attention.
I wouldn't know what that's like. I suppose the last question I'd have for you, since clearly no rating is to be given, and I feel suitably chastised by Magnus on this, are you feeling that you will watch it when it's back in May?
I might do. I think any answer that I give will reflect badly on the show. I really, really have to emphasise that I just don't watch things or do stuff. However, I did watch all of, you know, the three Tennant and Tate episodes and this one. I watched the Tennant ones primarily because my family watched them and I was also in the room. So it felt like a good excuse to sit and watch. And I enjoyed the first one. So then I wanted to see the arc complete itself.
Because like you said, we are fatigued. So standalone stories kind of work best. But we can't deny that an arc can draw us in. It can still, as long as the arc's not too long, it can be a successful model still.
Yes, and I often avoid watching things for so long that if I then end up watching one episode, I will then have to watch all episodes for all of time.
Yes, yes,
Like with Star Trek Lower Decks.
Yes, The Good Place potentially would be another one, maybe Magnus. Yes. It becomes a comfort space once.
I would say I'm definitely open to watching more of it. I think if it's anything like this one, it'll be good, it'll be fun, kind of revitalized, hopefully with some interesting like excavations of the Doctor's past, which I think would be interesting, definitely as the, you know, as a relative of people who are adopted and also abandoned at birth. That stuff messes you up, man.
It was an interesting and very contentious point for a lot of people, because that alluded to a revelation several, you know, a couple of years ago that he was not, or they were not a Time Lord per se, but they were from before that race even sort of came about and have a long history that exists before even the First Doctor, which stirred up a few frustrations. But again, like I said, I think for people like Davis, it's a godsend because it means that they can do one-off backstories of the Doctor using random guest people to play them, you know, from his far past. So you can see why that sort of stuff maybe energizes the potential for...
It does, yeah. And I think also it makes sense in a clever way, because like if you have a character who's constantly regenerating themselves and then also has to take time to acclimatize to their new self, things will be forgotten or overwritten or rewritten, or the lies that you tell yourself about who you are, or the misapprehensions about the world that you have from iteration to iteration or generation to generation can become more deeply embedded, so that because the Doctor is constantly on the move, constantly moving forwards, never looking back, there isn't that opportunity for self-reflection. So it does make sense in a clever way for there to be a lot about the Doctor that the Doctor doesn't know about themselves. And like you say, it's a very useful narrative device.
Yeah.
And when you have a show that's gone on for so long, you need to have those devices. Otherwise, the story and the characters stagnate.
These last four episodes kind of reintroduce a fluidity which goes beyond questions of identity and sexuality, but just simply in taking something when it becomes too structured and too reinforced, that you need to kind of shatter it a bit so it becomes free and flexible. And things like the bi-regeneration does that. It sort of gives more of a space to breathe and find new ways of, and again, the whole looking at magic and the goblins is something that Doctor hasn't really done before. Again, does that very much thing. It sort of opens the borders a bit. It sort of widens the territory.
I think the only thing that we haven't discussed is his accent.
Oh, go on then. What about his accent do you want to discuss?
Wild. Utterly wild.
Is that a positive wild?
I think because I saw him in Sex Education, I keep expecting him to have that particular English accent. So whenever he speaks, I am surprised. And it's also, he sounds very Scottish. He's Rwandan Scottish.
Yeah.
But he sounds very Scottish in particular turns of phrase, and then kind of ambiguously Scottish the rest of the time, and then a little bit English in other turns of phrase. So it's just wild. I mean, it's great, but it's definitely, I think, a unique characteristic.
It's just an incredible presence. And having watched Sex Education, and I never imagining that that, as you say, that he could, not that he couldn't, but never imagined how he would be as a central role in a show like Doctor Who.
And it definitely feels like a much more mature presence.
Yes.
Which I think is, you know, really defining for playing the Doctor as a role.
The accent's great. And it's funny when I think back to, say, Sylvester McCoy coming in with his the Seventh Doctor, and he had a Scottish accent, and at the time people would grumble that the Doctor was, you know, an English character.
He's from England, on planet Earth.
At the Gallifrey, the planet on in England.
The ex-British colony that we have to give back.
It is inherently British, isn't it? If you ever watch any of the ones with Gallifrey on. Before McCoy, Peter Davison, when he was a very young 27, 28-year-old playing the Doctor, and how that was absurd because he should be an older man. And before Tom Baker, you know, who was a sort of middle-aged 40s, that was too young. He should be a white-haired man. And then Eccleston coming along with his northernness.
The more you look at it, the more you see that actually the Doctor can be literally whatever, that any change is resisted in comparison to what came before.
Yes, strange that, isn't it? It's almost as if the people who are angry potentially about Jodie are probably less angry about Jodie if they found new stuff to be angry about, or the people are angry about, previous doctors. As I say, at the time, Christopher Eccleston playing a Northern Doctor was something that had to be acknowledged in the script.
Outrageous. Leather jacket, how dare.
Exactly, the leather jacket was something that had been done. Paul McGann before him having the first sort of screen kiss. You know, that was, again, now it seems positively tame.
So pre that kiss, was the assumption that the Doctor was asexual?
Yeah, pretty much.
Because now, if you did that, that would be almost woke again, given the popular discourse around identity politics.
Yeah. But I always felt, like Tom Baker, I always imagined that to be, say, like a gay man in the 70s, a character like Tom Baker, who, as you say, was not really meant to be sexual. Some people argue that he was clearly heterosexual because of his dynamic with Romana, who was his off-screen wife, which is where you can see where that dynamic's coming from. But there's nothing suggested in the show. But as someone who perhaps felt outside of society, whether it's sexually or otherwise, a hero which has no of those normative connections to having to have the love interest and whatever, that must be extremely attractive to in terms of feeling like that speaks to me more than Han Solo or Buck Rogers would speak to me, because this person isn't defined by who they like or who they don't like. They are just, that was kind of cool at the time, as you say, in some ways, perhaps to have that back then, where everything I was very heterosexual, was crazy, and again, quite progressive.
Straight all over the place.
Absolutely, Magnus, absolutely. Right, straight all over the place, I think is where we will leave it. That's a good title for this episode.
Straight all over the place.
I enjoyed it as well.
What was your favourite of the four then?
Oh, that's a good question. Possibly the third. The giggle, just because it was just ongoing. You know, the Neil Patrick Harris was excellent all the way through it.
Yeah.
It had a lot of nods to the past, but kept itself firmly looking forward. The bi-regeneration was fun. The ending was really cool as well. It was a really nice, positive ending. I really enjoyed that, but I did genuinely really enjoy this as well. I just didn't quite as enjoy it as much. And the things which I didn't think I was going to enjoy, like the musical number, I really enjoyed. Not because I had a problem with the musical number, but musical numbers can be depending on your tastes. I really enjoyed that, and I just felt some of the bits in the flat just went on a little longer than I would have liked. And I believe they were trimmed down a bit anyway, but again, the cast was all good.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah.
I think my favourite was still, you know, the bottle episode.
Yeah. Well, that was good, because I had no idea. I went into that without knowing where it was going to go. So I knew that they were going to the future or something, but beyond that, nothing. So that was a great one to watch. And but yeah, I know we said we'd finish, and I'm sorry, listener, but you know, again,
we're finishing. I've got things to do, places to be.
Possibly. But yeah, I think one thing out of all these four is that I think just to finish on is that there is that sort of confidence within the writing. That feels like he's dropping in those things which he wants to sort of demonstrate that where it's going. Even things like the mavity, which is still being played out as the new term for gravity. You know, there's a sense of continuity, a sense of confidence in doing what they want to do, and yet still giving people kind of what they want, which is a crazy doctor, a police box, and probably a hit and miss run of episodes.
I mean, it's got to be hit and miss. It's been going on for so long now that it simply has to be hit and miss. Otherwise, it will be entirely missed. And it's catering to a really broad audience for a really long space of time. So that audience has changed quite considerably. So, and I'm just very grumpy and I'm very picky.
As most of the internet apparently is, so I don't think you're alone.
I've heard.
Yeah. Something about the Straits. I can't remember.
All over the place.
Well, thank you very much for listening, listeners, or listener. We usually use a singular just on the assumption that there's at least one, but actually apparently it tends to be more than, well, you know. You assume it's just one cockroach and then you find there's just hundreds. It's just the way it is. But thank you for listening. And thanks for Magnus for coming on and doing this special episode. And the podcast will be back in some form in the near future.